Hello, and welcome to the UMFIF podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's episode, we talk about pensions, private markets, and the retailization of alternative asset classes. This is Pierre Orlieb from London, and today I'm speaking to Brian McMahon, Managing Director at BNY Mellon. So thanks for joining us, Brian. I think it makes a lot of sense for us to start with two sort of broad trends that have shaped the pensions landscape and their asset allocation since the financial crisis. One being the shift sort of from defined benefit to defined contribution plans, and the second being the emergence of private markets, really generally speaking, as an asset class that is attractive for pensions. Wondering, sort of starting with the first point, could you walk us through those two major trends that have taken place?
Sure, and thank you for having me. I think the shift from defined benefit to defined contribution schemes is well documented, and it's something that organizations have been moving to for 20 years. So it's not new. I think the fundamentals of DB and DC is how it impacts the members and how people are reacting to it. Because, you know, again, you're looking at DB schemes. In a DB scheme, the responsibility for, you know, the retirement benefits rest with the company. They're committing to, you know, an amount of income, an amount of retirement benefits for their members at a point in time. With defined contribution, the responsibility for that shifts to the members. And I think that's a fundamental shift, because obviously defined benefit schemes were expensive, because the companies were committing to a particular level of return for their members. And that, you know, if someone was living longer, better lifestyles, 20 years of retirement, it's very expensive for organizations, for corporates to continue with. With defined contribution schemes, the onus then, as I say, shifts to the members. And the question becomes, are the members educated enough? Do they understand their responsibilities? Do the trustees act in that way? I think one of the problems, or one of the key differences between DB and DC, is that DB can access private markets far easier than DC schemes. There are a number of studies that are out there that show that the retirement benefits that a member may have would reduce from anywhere between 12 and 17% by not accessing pension or private markets. Now that's fundamental. If you talk to Mr. Public on the street and you say, by virtue of the way DC schemes invest today, you can get £250 in your pocket, or if they allowed more investment, you could get £350 or £320. You know, it's a substantial difference to somebody's retirement income. And I know it's something that the FCA is looking at. There's consultations around it. The industry is trying to grapple with how to do it. But fundamentally, when you look at the whole shift from DB to DC, it's only going one way. It's all going to be more and more DC. DC has gone from 1.1 million schemes to about 8 million schemes, looking at the ONS, be it in default schemes or master trusts. You know, for me, it is obviously a primary level of investing going forward. And from a private markets perspective, the challenge is how can they access that investment type.
Right, yeah. So you have this shift towards DC, and as you say, for Mr. Public, it's a very alluring enterprise, right, because you have the kind of benefit of higher return. But so there are key challenges for DCs in investing in private markets, right? So, but before we get into the nitty-gritty, private markets have exploded since the crisis, but in a positive sense here. And so walk us through what the drivers of that have been. Why have public pension funds and, you know, other institutional investors like sovereign funds, why have they been so drawn to private markets, whereas they were sort of fairly, you know, not insignificant, but less of a major player before the crisis? What's been the driver there?
I think if you look at the growth of private markets, and private markets being private equity, real estate, infrastructure, private credit or debt, you can see that the level of investment today, or the level of commitment into the space, is approaching, what, 7 trillion? But approximately 2 trillion of dry powder. I think when people have looked at the returns that private equity or private markets generate, which typically are non-correlated to stocks, to bonds, they're longer term in nature, they've had historically a greater level of return. You know, people do still expect north of 10-15%. Not in every asset class, totally not. But from the point of view of having a diversified risk return profile, each can contribute, whether it's real estate, whether it's debt, private equity, infrastructure. And if you look at the needs of the real economy, the funding for the real economy has to come from somewhere. If you are on a real estate side, do you want to have a financer that is a bank, which in a time of downturn may want to recover the assets, versus a fund that's investing for the longer term with a different profile? I think funds have, you know, private equity funds, real estate funds, etc., have become a primary source of finance for the real economy. They finance SME lending, they finance infrastructure. I think the impact on all of our lives cannot be underestimated. And when people consider how it affects them individually, I would suggest that anybody listening to this is affected, because every single one of us in our pension scheme somewhere is investing through into private markets. And what we can see is, if you look at the returns or the amount of investment last year in private markets, it was circa 600 billion globally. So with two trillion of dry powder, that shows you that in sort of 3 years, which is a typical investment life cycle of a fund, that that would be drawn down. If you look at how the industry has performed since the crisis, the level of transparency, the level of regulation has increased significantly. The level of protection for investors has increased significantly with the likes of AFMD. And the different investors, be it say German insurance clients that are going through the German insurance ordinance, they need to invest through EU funds with EU depository. And you now see investors understand the asset class more. There's greater education, there's greater understanding, there's greater expectation of timeliness in terms of data, there's greater expectation in terms of return and risk management.
Yeah, so the overall picture that I'm getting from what you said is that, I mean, private markets have become a popular and increasingly appealing asset class for pensions, for Mr. Public. And that's reflected in kind of the quantities that have been allocated to it. But it seems we're circling around some of the key challenges here. And you touched on it a few times, I think, when you talked about sort of the contrast between banks and more long-term investors like pensions. And that challenge really is kind of the question of liquidity, right? And when we talk about liquidity in the context of, you know, a kind of pension fund investing in private markets, that's in the context of the kind of retailization of private markets, the question really is how a retail investor in a DC would react to, say, a potential downturn, how they would behave in the context of their allocation to something where that's not necessarily very liquid. So can I ask you to walk us through the key challenges in private markets when it comes to liquidity? What's the tension there?
Sure. I think the first point to say is that anybody investing in private markets should be a long-term investor. This is not putting cash on an overnight deposit. You cannot sell a window of a building, you know, if you want your cash out. So when we're looking at private markets and the retailization of private markets, that's a theme that people have been discussing and trying to crack for in excess of 10 years. And you're right. The point is that for Joe Public, they want the access. They want to be able to gain their cash back at point of crisis. We have a number of different components then. We have the actual structural framework of the funds, and we have the level of understanding, education to pension scheme trustees and their members. On the former, the funds that we run that are aimed toward DC tend to have a mixture of redemption gates, which stop effectively a run on the fund, which is not uncommon, And they manage that level of redemption requirements by having a liquidity pool within the fund. So they will invest in sector-specific funds that allow for a level of redemption. Now, typically that percentage, you know, is part of an overall management scheme, because if that liquidity pool is too high, then it becomes simply a normal equity bond fund. So it has to have the right balance. And typically I would see the redemption gates being at roughly 10% of the value of a fund. That means that in any year, no more than 10% can redeem or look for redemption, and funds may have optionality to defer redemptions, and those mechanisms are well tried and well tested in the market. I think for when it comes into the retailization side of it, the fact that the trustees or the fact that the members want to be able to redeem, there has to be a sufficient understanding of what these assets are. This is not somebody approaching 60 looking to get the last bit of return before they retire. This is for those pension that want to grow. This is capital growth phase that people want to invest into. I think one of the key points here is that as DB schemes fall away and DC schemes become more prevalent, the level of investment that needs to be funneled is going to grow and grow and grow. The liquidity side of things, there will always be people who want to exit. There will always be members that, you know, want to draw down on their pensions. But I think the fundamental here is for people to understand the asset class that they're getting into.
That's right. And I just want to touch on the first thing you said again about the redemption gates. But it seems to me that kind of brushes over one of the more fundamental challenges with investment in private markets, which is that, you know, it's hard to get valuation very frequently, right? It's impossible to value something like, you know, infrastructure on a daily basis. And for, you know, a sort of retail investor with a DC, it seems like that would be a source of concern. Could you walk us through how that kind of challenge of valuation and data gaps has been dealt with?
I think you're right. One of the constant questions is, how do I value something like that? You know, if you're selling your home, you don't know what your home is worth until you go to sell it. And even then, the agent that comes and gives you a value doesn't know until it's sold. And the same holds true here. You know, the assets, you will only know their true worth when you realize their sale. That said, when we look at the actual investments, the industries that they're in, the sectors that they're in, the countries that they're in, asset managers are able to look at whether those assets are performing or not performing. They're able to understand if there's any economic shocks that they need to take account of. If there's a downturn in the property market, you know, the value of those funds will go down. If there's an upturn, the values go up. There are external valuers. If you look at AFMD brought in very strict requirements around valuation, whether it's an independent internal valuation committee or an external valuer. Now, when you bring these through to a DC scheme, the challenge is that a traditional PE fund will employ an external valuer on a less frequent basis than the daily pricing that's going into DC. You know, most private market funds are monthly or quarterly. The value is then released perhaps 30 days after that. So if you're looking at the price on the 1st of January, you know, you're probably looking at a value that's been released by the asset manager maybe 60 days ago. So in DC schemes that we run, the asset managers are then looking at how to consider each of the investments on a daily basis. So daily valuation adjustments are being considered. Is there something significant that has to change? And all of our daily funds have that process running. And it very much is down to the asset manager, their valuation principles, back testing it, consideration of can they unpick the industry segments, compare it to kind of benchmark analysis. And I would suggest asset managers are becoming ever more sophisticated in that. So there still is a difference between the traditional private markets type valuation and the DC requirements. But I think asset managers are working really hard to close that down. And I can see that by the virtue of the valuation policies and principles that our clients employ.
Yeah, so that's kind of the data gap issue that you've addressed, and the kind of lags that are involved in this process. Asset managers are responding to that with increasing sophistication and things like that. The other kind of major obstacle to sort of DC investment in private markets, I think, is costs, right? So typically there would be sort of quite hefty fees that are charged for that kind of investment. And that obviously is kind of, you know, a major outstanding risk factor. What do you make of that challenge for DC pensions?
You're right, the cost cap. Yeah. You know, 75 basis points for most private market type asset managers would be a bridge too far if that was the only fund that the DC scheme was going into. There's various studies that show that typically the average cost that DC schemes are paying is somewhere between 30 and 76 basis points, so the average about 50. Mm. Given the fact that, you know, if that private markets wouldn't be the sole component of any DC scheme, adding private markets products to it, yes, will increase the overall average from perhaps 50 to 60, 70, but it of itself shouldn't breach the 75 basis points cap. I think asset managers also understand the challenge of having a product that has that kind of cost consideration built in. And certainly the ones that we run have their management charges aligned accordingly. I will say that the funds need a certain scale to be economically beneficial, because right now some of the funds that are smaller, that are charging the lower rates, they're doing so because they know they can't charge the higher amounts because of it'll breach the cap. So that said, they're anticipating that these funds will get to a scale where it becomes economically viable to run. I think the industry knows it. The industry looks for ever more automation in how the funds run. And when looking at the cost side of things, cost obviously is an important consideration for any of the pension fund trustees. You know, there's plenty of evidence that a lot of trustees spend a lot of time focusing on it. However, I don't believe that pension fund trustees focus on cost to the exclusion of the value creation. You know, fundamentally, they have a fiduciary responsibility to look after their members' interests. And the return that's generated out of private markets is such that I don't think trustees can ignore it.
So in that context, the kind of the ever ongoing story of pension fund consolidation in the UK is particularly beneficial for their investment in private markets, right? That's something that they'll be able to do to a more economically viable degree the more they consolidate. But that process obviously takes a while, and I think one of the kind of overarching concerns that sort of dominate private markets is the question of how long the kind of boom in, especially in private equity, can keep going. I think, you know, now obviously pension funds, you know, like CalPERS, people like that, they're turning to private equity for their returns to make up for lagging returns in other asset classes. What's your outlook for private markets? Are you sort of fairly optimistic about their ability to continuously provide the kind of returns that we've seen over the past decade or so? Are you quite optimistic about that?
I see a lot of demand for the product. Mm-hmm. I see ever-increasing commitments, fund sizes, demand from investors to come in. What that will do is severalfold. One, it will increase the competition for the actual assets. Do I think that private markets will have, I'll call it, the super returns that they've had in the past? Maybe, maybe not. But the spectrum of private markets is vast. If someone's going for a leveraged buyout fund, if someone's going for a secondaries fund, if someone's going for an SME fund, for venture capital, for debt, what is debt? Is debt infra? Is it commercial real estate? Is it corporate debt? Is it US senior loan? Is it MES? So the range of risk type products is quite large. So it's not that someone's going into private equity, they're going into a buyout fund. And the different strategies obviously come with different return targets. I think that the industry has proven itself to be a consistent performer. if you looked at the last crisis, it was probably more robust than perhaps the more liquid assets, which by definition reacted to the volatility that was going on at the time. And those that were able to withstand, to be patient, have proven themselves to be successful. I do think the adage of the big get bigger, you know, is there. And that's largely linked to the fact that they have proven returns. Do I think, you know, the assets will by definition be ever growing? Well, I don't think any investment you could ever look at and go, yes, it'll always be positive. You know, real estate, for example, look at when the Brexit vote happened. Real estate funds, in, you know, open-end real estate funds in the UK dropped 10-15%, you know, because people had uncertainty as to what the value is. Those have since recovered. So can you have a crystal ball and say that this would most definitely do this? No. But if you look at the trends, if you look at the empirical evidence, they have been consistent in their returns. And I think the asset managers are becoming ever more rigorous around how they manage the assets and how they look for value creation as part of it. So do I think it is an important part of an investor's diversified portfolio? Absolutely.
Yeah, I think you're right, obviously, and nothing is foolproof. Are you working on anything in particular, any interesting research that you want to share that you're working on at the moment?
We have a paper coming out soon, actually, on the whole shift from DBDC. We have a number of partners that have worked with us on it, Partners Group, Pantheon, NeCredit, PwC. I personally, and this is a personal comment, I think the shift from DBDC is a fundamental change in the pensions industry. And I think we have to address how DC schemes can access. You know, we'll be publishing that paper shortly. I will welcome any comments. We will see greater evolution on the fund structuring to enable it to work and greater automation in the industry to make it cost effective and allow for the daily liquidity and the pricing requirements to do that. We put a lot of work in to our infrastructure already to support it. As Partners Group say, they believe that this is the future of fundraising for private markets.
Thank you, Brian, for joining us. It's been great to speak to Brian McMahon from BNY Mellon on the shift from DB to DC pensions and what they can do to access private markets. If you've enjoyed the program, then please do leave us your comments and follow us on the OnTheFifth channel. We are now on iTunes and Spotify. We release podcasts every Tuesday. Also, keep an eye out for a link to the BNY Mellon paper that Brian mentioned at the end of the podcast, which we'll try to include in the podcast description.